just undertones. We can take it in three, I guess, three levels. So on the political level, I would say the Zionist undertone or tone is that Palestine solidarity is part of Chavismo. The Venezuelan revolution is, you know, some people call it the Bolivarian revolution or Chavismo because of the president who was the person who led that movement for the first decade and a half. And Chavez was always in solidarity with Palestine. There's clips people see where he interrupts himself in the middle of a speech to say, and I just like to say, God damn the state of Israel. And, you know, if you look at any public meeting, any of the politicians, the keffiyeh is everywhere. The Palestinian flag is everywhere. And the important thing is there are lots of politicians and leaders all over the world who have Palestinian solidarity as part of their politics. But at a state level, as an official part of the state, there's only a handful. And Venezuela is one of them. So just to contrast with Colombia, Gustavo Petro is anti-genocide. He's always anti-genocide. He always brings up the issue of Gaza, but it's understood in Colombia and elsewhere as Gustavo Petro's politics. And when there's an election, even if it's someone from his party, they might not have the same politics. And it's like understood as like his personal position. Venezuela, it's a part of the revolution. It's a part of their politics. So taking down a country or a leader, a president, where the solidarity with Palestine is part of the state's approach, that's a win for Zionists. That's something Zionists want to do. They want to stick it to that state. They want to show that that's going to be punished. And so that's one undertone. In terms of the military undertone, the whole approach of this kidnapping of Maduro, of President Maduro, was more like an assassination. It has a lot of the Israeli assassination military technique to it in terms of the electronic warfare, the overkill, bombing all kinds of areas just as collateral distraction, and then taking out the leader. It's a decapitation. They did it with the 12-day war on Iran. They did it with the pager attack on Lebanon. Of course, so much of what they do in Gaza is trying to hunt and kill leaders, and they have total impunity to do it. And that is all very much Zionist undertone. And then in terms of the information space, I would say that a Zionist undertone could also be the way that the story is invented and unfolds. So the atrocity propaganda that EI spends so much time debunking of the atrocities that happened on October 7th, which, you know, when you look at the reporting, the whole story breaks down, but the story keeps reviving itself. And that's for a very specific political purpose. And I would say that this story of like betrayal, that like Maduro was betrayed, also is one of these stories that has a specific political purpose that we'll get into. But I think the purpose, I'll spoil it a little bit, is to make people not want to take action in solidarity with Venezuela, but to kind of say, ooh, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's an inside job. So all of these things, the way they use information propaganda, the nature of the military strike and the political objective of punishing a state in solidarity with Palestine, I think all of those things are Zionist undertones.
Let's thread through the psyops, these speculations. Talk a little bit more about how you are approaching an overview of what we should be skeptical of, what you've been skeptical of, and why it's important to remain critical of these, you know, of these rumors, these speculations, painting it as an inside job. And we see this always whenever there's some sort of eruption within Palestinian resistance or political leadership. There's a lot of speculation about how, you know, someone was paid off by the Israelis, or an entire political faction or armed resistance faction is just a product of Israeli-US money and approach. So how are you looking at that, and why should we be critical and skeptical?
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that one, the whole Qatar money stuff that just occurred to me as we were talking about it as a connection. But okay, so when something like this happens, this is a warfare operation. It's an imperial intervention. And the first thing to understand is that the information is part of this campaign. Everything that you hear that is coming from any source like the CIA or the unnamed source in the Washington Post or an unnamed source that has insider knowledge is suspect, and it should be understood as part of the operation. Information and operations are part of warfare now. If you didn't understand that by now, please catch up. It is a part of the military campaign. It's understood explicitly. You know, if you look at U.S. manuals on fifth generation warfare is basically inducing psychological collapse in the enemy through a combination of what they call kinetic and information operations. So if your enemy can just be so demoralized and confused and they don't know what's going on and they give up, then you've applied fifth generation warfare successfully. In terms of people who are looking for an understanding of what happened specifically on January 3rd, when you look at experts, I would suggest you look at the experience and the background of the expert because, for example, and I'm going to pick a little bit on the Russia sphere for various reasons, there's a lot of people who watch the Russia-Ukraine war and know a lot about the weapons and the advanced technology and all of the doctrine that's being applied. And they're, you know, a lot of them are very pro-Russia. So people think, okay, well, to be pro-Russia, you have to be very skeptical of U.S. narratives. You must be kind of anti-imperialist. And then you look at what they say about Venezuela, and I don't think that's quite accurate. They're reading, and I think it's biased because they want to say that Russia never does anything wrong. And so if Russia supplied all these weapons to Venezuela and Venezuela still lost on the night of the 3rd, it's not, as I was saying, I said on the night of the 3rd, the night after, I guess, I said, nobody wins the first day with the Americans. The Americans always win day one. They won day one on the 12-day war. They killed most of the military command. They always win day one. They won day one against Vietnam. There's no day, Afghanistan, they invaded. The Taliban didn't drive them out until 20 years later. So the Americans always win day one. The Israelis always win day one. You don't have to have a conspiratorial special thing. And what I've found the Russia sphere analysts do is they say, well, that's because Latinos are corrupt. It's because they don't fight. It's because they can't fight. He was bribed. And that's all basically to kind of preserve their view that Russia couldn't have done anything wrong. And I don't even necessarily think Russia did anything wrong or that there was anything wrong with the Russian weapons. You're talking about an American operation where they had unlimited time to set up. They had unlimited resources. They're facing a country that's been sanctioned for 20 years. They controlled the airspace. They controlled the naval approaches. And they attacked exactly at a time and place of their choosing and did something that nobody was anticipating. Why is that so shocking that they would have succeeded? Why does that have to mean that the Russian weapons failed or the Venezuelans are cowards or that the Cubans betrayed them or that it doesn't. None of that has to be the case. And so just watch for the biases and watch for where they're coming from. You know, we come from a place of our analysis is always of Israel's wars, of the Palestinian resistance when we think of guerrilla warfare. So when we think of guerrilla warfare and information operations, I always think of Bassel el-Arraj and the 7 rules of war that he talked about, where he says, you know, guerrilla war isn't based on fixed points and borders. Don't look at a map and get stressed out. Photos and images are part of psychological warfare. Never spread the occupation's propaganda and do not contribute to instilling a sense of defeat. Assassinations are part of psychological warfare. The resistance losses will be much greater, and that's natural. So all of those things are so important, and I think it's really telling that came from someone in the Palestinian context who was analyzing the armed struggle from that perspective. Now, again, Venezuela is different, and they have a different concept of defensive warfare as well. They have their own concept of how to fight in the event of an American invasion. They don't see, they understand they're not a peer of the United States. They can't match the American air power and electronic warfare and technology. So they have to go with this political concept of, unity and not surrendering and, mobilizing the people. So that's how I try to approach this kind of information space, if you will.
Everything you said, Justin, is, I think, really on the mark. And that's how all of us, for the most part, experience this. We're not in Venezuela. We're not seeing directly what happens. We're seeing it mediated through, particularly many of us, social media. And in that space, we know there is so much misinformation and propaganda, just as there was about October 7th. So, for example, the internet was flooded with videos allegedly of Venezuelans celebrating the kidnapping of President Maduro. Turns out those videos were either from other countries, you know, Venezuelan gusanos, exiles, or they were completely unrelated old videos. And we saw the same recently with the protests or reported protests in Iran, where all of these top neocon, pro-Israel, anti-Iran types were spreading photos and videos, including U.S. officials, that were AI-generated and that they didn't look closely enough. So one that was circulated, for example, by the pro-Israel group, the Anti-Defamation League, featured a two-headed Iranian police officer. So it just goes to show that almost everything, so much of what we're being fed is fabricated, but that also produces this context where people are second guessing and questioning everything and saying, well, that can't be the real story. It must be something else. And right. So it's very sort of salutary to hear you say, just, you know, take it back to basics, analyze things from the basics, that there may sometimes be a more straightforward situation. The U.S., after all, is a massive superpower. They have been building this, what Donald Trump calls the biggest, most powerful armada in history in the Caribbean Sea off the coast of Venezuela for weeks and months, and also working to overthrow the government of Venezuela for literally decades. So those points are all well taken. Now, let's kind of shift, we'll broaden out a bit from Venezuela. Now, on the one hand, the behavior of the United States seems to have broken with any previous norms. There's just something so brazen, so spectacular about this attack on Venezuela. But on the other hand, anyone who knows history knows that invading other countries, the mass killing of civilians, whether in Vietnam, Cambodia, Haiti, Iraq, any other number of countries you could name, the overthrowing and covert assassination of leaders, the theft of resources, installing puppet regimes, all of this has been as American as apple pie since the United States was founded. And of course, for more than 2 years, U.S. administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have fully backed Israel's genocide in Gaza. So, Justin, from your perspective, what, if anything, do you think is different about this moment?
There are a few things that are different. And I think it's the way the system evolves. It's like the moment we're in continuity and the evolution. Like, legally speaking, or in terms of the pretext of international law, I think it's a pretty unique moment in terms of that all being gone. In terms of like the drug war, the way they used to do the drug war was they would have captured these boats and they would have either planted evidence or, you know, what they're presumably going to do with when they put Maduro on trial. They'll make things up and they'll claim that there are drugs there that they either manufactured themselves or impounded from somewhere else, and try to make these cases against the people they want to invade. But instead, they just started blowing boats up. They started blowing up boats in the Caribbean. So that's different. And that, I think, is the post-2023 world. Like, the Israel, you know, just blows things up when they want. And America blows things up when they want. There's not going to be any punishment. There will be some strongly worded memos, and there's nothing for them to fear. There's no consequences for that. I think we're still at the beginning of that. I think we're at the beginning of what the Americans increasingly realize they can get away with. That's why they're talking about Greenland now. That's why, you know, Canada could be next. You don't have to be an enemy to be attacked by the Americans at this point. And so there's an evolution of the lawlessness and a brazenness, like you mentioned. There's a continuity too, which I want to kind of make sure people understand. And that's an ideological hatred for any pro-people agenda, democracy, socialism, or whatever. So when you look at the overthrow of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004 and prior in 1990, the same politician, the same Haitian politician overthrown twice by the Americans in Haiti, he was trying to raise the minimum wage. Cuba, constantly a target of sanctions, including in some ways like the attacks on the theft of Venezuelan oil and the attacks on these oil tankers that they followed up the attacks on fishermen with. The oil tankers, the first big one was intended for Cuba to try to break the energy blockade on Cuba. And Iran too. Iran ideologically, like Venezuela, ideologically the state is supportive of Palestine. It's part of their constitution. It's part of their state ideology. And so this is something that people miss when they think too much about resources like oil. Chavismo would be the target even if the oil was all turned into blue cheese overnight. Even if the Americans get less oil, they would still target Chavismo because of the ideology, the idea of people mobilizing to get things from the government, the idea of solidarity with Cuba and Haiti and Palestine, even with poor people in the U.S., the idea of energy independence or food independence, food sovereignty, media independence, integration with the Americas. All of these things are things that the Americans would target regardless of the resource situation. And that's the target above all. And then the other thing that I think, you know, is different about this moment in terms of the way that the situation evolves. It's a connection between the Gaza war and the Venezuela war that I think I want to kind of emphasize, which is that part of what's driven the Americans and the Israelis to such brutal genocidal levels is, in both cases, in Gaza and in Venezuela, the actual inability to get collaborators. So people still think that imperialism is primarily about firepower. Imperialism is primarily about collaborators. And firepower is what they use when they can't get the collaborators that they need.
So what do you make of the fact? I want to, again, we're you are broadening it out. So I don't want to make this question about Venezuela per se, but about this point about collaborators. They built up this right-wing pro-Israel extremist, Maria Corina Machado. They gave her the Nobel Prize, yet they couldn't, even Trump had to admit she has no support. I mean, they keep telling us that Maduro, Chavismo in Venezuela is so unpopular. I didn't see a single documented video of people in Venezuela celebrating. I mean, I don't see everything, but I watch things. I didn't see anything. And even they admitted they couldn't foist her on Venezuela credibly. Do you think that supports this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's a prize from Norway. And there's someone on the Nobel committee that's Venezuelan or like Norwegian Venezuelan. I think Julian Assange is suing them, the Nobel committee, for misappropriating funds for Maria Corina Machado. So yeah, I mean, they've tried so many with the story in Venezuela is such a story of the collaborators failing to do the job. In 2002, there was a coup that lasted 2 days. They got some collaborators at the highest level of the army to overthrow Chavez, but the middle and lower ranks of the army weren't having it. And so they brought Chavez back. The same kind of pattern happened in 2003. They tried to bring the oil company down by the managers, the upper echelons of the oil company going on strike. But then the middle and lower layers of the oil company just took over managing and kept the company running. So in each case, they're foiled by the inability to get the most important people in the organization, which is the middle layers and the lower layers, on board with the coup. Then they tried actually running in the elections and trying to participate in the democratic process, and they kept losing for years and years. And then they tried declaring this Juan Guaido president. And all of those efforts coming to nothing culminate in using the Air Force, all of the forces of the American military, all of the branches, 150 aircraft from every boat in the Caribbean, and kidnapping the president. So and that does kind of remind me of Gaza, where you had Yahya Sinwar in particular building this system that made it impossible for the Israelis to find collaborators. And so like this whole genocide has unfolded in this way because the Israelis couldn't get collaborators. And at the end, as you guys have reported so much, you know, they tried to get this thing with forgot the guy's name. He's already faded from history, but they had this leader they manufactured who was ultimately executed by one of the resistance groups. Mm-hmm. And it's just this constant failure of collaborating. And that tells you kind of how this conflict will unfold in the future. And a lot of these conflicts, that's what you have to watch. You have to watch whether they're able to overcome the fact that nobody in these societies wants anything to do with Israel or the Americans.
And speaking of collaborators, Axios reported that the Trump administration is planning to announce its so-called Board of Peace to rule over Gaza, and that it will include the UK, Germany, France, Italy, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey. But Axios is also saying that, quote, the plan could still change depending on developments on other issues in Trump's foreign policy agenda, like Venezuela and the Ukraine-Russia peace talks. How does this overview tie the attack on Venezuela to events in Southwest Asia? Does it give us any signal about a new or imminent U.S. attack on Iran? And what is Gaza's place in all this? Did the so-called international community's normalization of the Gaza genocide create this world that we're now in?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely did. And I think that with Venezuela, I mean, this is what I'm struggling with, because Venezuela's military doctrine is not based on deterrence. It's based on defense. It's based on defending the territory through basically a people's army. So they recognize right away that they're not going to be able to inflict proportional or any kind of damage on the Americans in the Caribbean Sea. So like people said, like, why don't they do it like the Houthis? But it's like Ansarullah in Yemen was also pretty restrained for a really long time. And for a long time between 2015 and I think 2022, they also had a similar concept. They were taking a pounding and they were basically saying, you can't successfully invade Yemen and you're not going to be able to dislodge us. The people are with us and we're going to fight. And so, you know, the idea of a missile force that can offer some kind of deterrence, that's new. That's also new. That's also that's the world that Ansarullah brought us. And Iran also has that ability, right? So Iran has this ability that, again, they started building up over in the 1980s. So it's not something you can, you know, it's not something Venezuela could just come up with, right? This is the Iranian missile program is something that started developing in the 1980s. And nobody knew really what they were capable of until these wars with Israel. And in these wars with Israel, I think a lot of people on all sides were probably quite surprised by how much the Iranians were able to do in terms of their missile force.
So does it make, I mean, just to, you know, to focus in on part of Nora's question there, so does it make any sense to you if the U.S. and Israel were indeed so surprised by Iran's capabilities that we saw demonstrated in June, that they succeeded in almost exhausting the American and Israeli missile defenses while inflicting severe damage in Israel, albeit without, you know, while still being very careful in what they were targeting? They didn't target sort of general infrastructure and so on. Does it make sense that the U.S. and Israel would be getting ready, as some reports, maybe speculation, but for example, I heard an interview yesterday with Chaz Freeman, a former U.S. ambassador, very knowledgeable about the region, saying that he's aware that the U.S. is moving huge quantities of weapons, C-5A Galaxy transport aircraft are carrying, according to him, huge quantities of weapons to Israel. And he speculates that this is in preparation for a strike on Iran. Does that make any sense to you? If Iran is capable of inflicting, but what does the world look like from Tel Aviv or from Washington where they're willing to do this again?
Yeah.
I think when we were studying the Gaza war as it unfolded, I kept thinking they accept a ceasefire because their army reaches a level of exhaustion, and then they forget. They forget why they accepted the ceasefire, and then they start building up for another attack, and then they do it all again. And I think there were three cycles like this in Gaza. So each time you could say, and I remember John saying it many times, why are they going to do this again when the outcome is going to be the exact same? Lebanon is also not out of the running, even though the outcome will be the same.
We do not know what the days and weeks ahead will bring. We can wake up to anything in this world. And I'm grateful that, Justin, your insights, the care, your analysis always comes from very careful reading and observation. That's why I find it, and so many other people find it, very valuable. So you are often on the Anti-Empire Project YouTube channel. You have your blog, and you provide regular, fascinating, well-informed updates. So I encourage people to subscribe to the Anti-Empire Project YouTube channel and to check out your website. We're so grateful, Justin. Thank you so much for your great insight.
Thanks, Justin.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
All right.
That was writer, podcaster, and academic Justin Podor. You can find his work at the Anti-Empire Project at podor.org. That's podur.org. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Celebrating Vancouver's underground rock music culture for 3 days of shows from incredible local and touring artists, the second annual Unreal City Festival takes over the Rickshaw Theater and the Russian Hall, January 15th to 17th. Featuring local artists like Worry War, Jody Glenham, CJSF chart toppers Devour, and the Houseplants. Scene veterans By a Thread, and headliner Spencer Krug of Wolf Parade, Sunset Rubdown, and Moonface. This unique festival finds bands and music artists upstairs, while downstairs you get access to the coziest grandma's living room style lounge in the city, with DJs, hot food, drinks, on-site tattoo artists, and more. The second annual Unreal City Festival, January 15th to 17th at the Rickshaw Theater and the Russian Hall in East Vancouver. For passes, go to unrealcity.rocks or head to CJSF Music on Instagram to win tickets.